Welcome to Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian Lebeau. This week we continue our second series of special programs on the U.S. Constitution. The series is based on a project launched by the Bill of Rights Institute titled Founders and the Constitution in Their Own Words, a two-volume collection of materials intended to add to our understanding of the remarkable stories of America's founders. This week we focus on the idea of limited government in James Madison. But first, let's look at some items of historical interest in the news you may have missed. Nearly three decades before the September 11th attacks, a high-level government panel developed plans to protect the nation against terrorist acts, according to recently declassified documents. Unless governments take basic precautions, we will continue to stand at the edge of an awful abyss, Robert Cooperman, chief scientist for the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, wrote in a 1977 report that summarized nearly 5 years of work by the Cabinet Committee to Combat Terrorism. President Richard Nixon formed the group in September 1972 after Palestinian commandos killed 11 Israeli athletes at the Munich Olympics. It is vital that we take every possible action ourselves and in concert with other nations designed to assure against acts of terrorism, Nixon wrote, in asking his Secretary of State, William Rogers, to oversee the task force. It's equally important that we be prepared to act quickly and effectively in the event that, despite all efforts at prevention, an act of terrorism occurs involving the United States, either at home or abroad, the president added. And the man who saved America, and probably the world, is living out his days on a small pension in a dark apartment in a Moscow suburb. Stanislav Petrov has a small life now, but there was a time when Petrov, now 65, was a privileged member of the Soviet Union's military elite, a lieutenant colonel on the fast track to a generalship. And on September 26, 1983, he was in charge of the secret bunker where a team of 120 technicians and military officers monitored the Soviet Union's early warning system. It was just after midnight when a new satellite array known as OCO, or the Eye, spotted five American missiles heading toward Moscow. The Eye identified them as Minuteman II nuclear missiles, and Petrov's computer was demanding that he follow protocol and confirm an incoming attack to his superiors. And he knew that the timeline was short. The Kremlin had only 12 minutes or so to respond. Nevertheless, he composed himself, looked at the data coming from the Eye. Why only five missiles? That did not fit with either his training or his logic. He assumed that if the United States was going to launch a first strike, it would unleash hundreds of missiles, not just five. Relations between the United States and the Soviet Union were worse than they had been for some time, so an attack was not out of the question. Nevertheless, and even though he was uncertain as to the true nature of what he was witnessing, Petrov called his superiors and reported a false alarm. Soviet engineers eventually discovered that Petrov was right, that the Eye had sounded the alarm when it spotted what turned out to be flashes of sunlight reflecting off clouds over Minutemen silos in Montana. But Petrov received no decorations or commendations for his action. Instead, he was reprimanded for not filling out his logbook as events unfolded. When we return, I'll be speaking with David Marion about the Founding Fathers and their thoughts on limited government. This is Talking History. With me this week for another in our series on the United States Constitution, highlighting a project launched by the Bill of Rights Institute titled Founders and the Constitution, is David Marion. Marion is Elliott Professor of Political Science at Hampton Sydney College and director of the Wilson Center for Leadership in the Public Interest. He also authored the essay on limited government for the Founders Project. Welcome, David.
Happy to be with you, Brian.
You write that among the principles that motivated the Founding Fathers was the idea that government be given only limited powers and that those powers be described in written charters or constitutions. Now, today, this seems pretty obvious, but not so in the 17th and 18th centuries, which is the time period you cover in your essay. So let's talk about the historical context of those ideas, or how the Founding Fathers came to that conclusion. Maybe you could start by talking about the ideas of Locke and Montesquieu.
Brian, the French theorist Alexis de Tocqueville called the colonists Anglo-Americans in his well-known work, Democracy in America. That was a good characterization of us, since America during the colonial period really was defined by many things that were generally British or English, but some things that were not. American social and political practices, for example, were more democratic and egalitarian than what existed in the motherland. But if we were Americans, we still were Anglo-Americans, and we were strongly influenced by British political theory, British history, and the common law tradition. It was to this tradition that we traced the principle that governments should be there to protect the rights of the people. John Locke had written about this in his second treatise on civil government. The continental theorist Montesquieu had written about this as well. Documents such as the Magna Carta, the English Bill of Rights, the Habeas Corpus Act all reflected this principle. Alongside this principle went the belief that the power of civil governments should be limited and subject to checks. Otherwise, rights would be held only tenuously by the people. We associate the phrase government of laws and not of men, as well as the doctrine of separation of powers, with this tradition, with this British tradition, but also with the continental tradition that was developing and was reflected in the work of Montesquieu. The ideal, really, for these people was governance through sensible laws that applied to everyone, even government officials. And this thinking was reflected in the charters that we had in this country prior to the written constitutions and then in our constitutions.
Okay, let's pick up on the charters and move forward on this side of the Atlantic. And you write about John Adams as an important figure in the development of the idea of limited government. Tell us what he believed and what he did to promote this idea prior to the Constitutional Convention.
Adams believed passionately in self-government, and he wrote about it as well, about the benefits and the virtues of self-government. He believed that the people are the only sure guardians of natural rights. And he, like the other founding fathers, so many of them, thought that Providence had positioned the American people to demonstrate for all mankind that free governments could be both decent and effective. He clearly believed that human beings were up to the job of self-government. He knew it would be a tough job, that it would not be an easy job, but it was something that was doable. It is Adams who is most prominently associated with the post-Declaration Massachusetts Constitution, which in turn influenced the deliberations of the delegates who attended the Constitutional Convention of 1787. And out of that convention came, of course, the United States Constitution that guides us today. That Massachusetts Constitution declared in some of its earliest passages that governments exist to protect the rights of the people and that they should be based on the consent of the people. It's hard not to be struck when you look at that Constitution by the number of provisions that have to do with securing the rights of the people and that impose limits on the government's ability to tax, to engage in unreasonable searches of private homes, or to impose cruel and unusual punishments on the people. Now, one provision that has received a lot of attention specifically requires that the departments of government be separate, that the legislative, executive, and judicial powers should not be combined. Here, for Adams and for many of the Americans of the founding period, was an important institutional device intended to check abuses of government and to reduce the likelihood of governmental tyranny.
Okay, I want to underscore what you're doing here for our listeners because it's important, but to me, what you show in your essay is this step-by-step development toward what we find in the U.S. Constitution. You talked about the English background, you moved to the Massachusetts Constitution, and we have one more stop along the way, I suppose, and that's the Articles of Confederation. And tell us how that did or did not embody the idea of limited government.
The Articles really constitute our first general constitution for the 13 former colonies, now states. On its face, it looks like that document violates an important principle of limited government, that is, that powers be separated, because under the Articles of Confederation, we consolidated all power in a unicameral legislature. But what we should conclude from this fact is not that they were not committed to the principle of limited government, but that they understood that they were giving so little power to the central government that there was no threat that the government could become tyrannical, so it would be okay to concentrate the power in a one-house legislature. But even this doesn't tell the whole story. America at that time was a country with power divided between a weak central government and sovereign states. The states were still sovereign, and it was their courts that the central government was going to have to use in disputes with the states. And that meant that we had a nice check in the state courts on the central legislature. I should add that we have in the Articles some important rules of the game that are set out with regard to how the central government and the states could use their powers. There was protection, for example, for property, and the states were limited in terms of what they could do in foreign or international affairs.
Okay. Yet many would believe that the Articles of Confederation were too weak, picking up on what you were just mentioning about trying to limit the powers of central government by the power of the states. So when the people that were involved in writing the Constitution arrive in Philadelphia in 1787, they really have as an objective creating a stronger central government, but in many ways, as you suggest in your essay, that makes it even more important to put limits on government. And they were largely guided by the Virginia Plan. So tell us about how they got started in that direction.
The Virginia Plan, Brian, was one of two documents that Madison had worked on prior to the convention. Unlike the Articles, the Virginia Plan anticipated the Constitution that we have today by proposing the creation of a two-house legislature and separate executive and judicial branches. The national legislature would be entrusted with the power to negative laws passed by the states and could call out the forces of the Union against any state that did not fulfill its duties under the Constitution. So the Virginia Plan, in short, really did propose to replace the Articles with a national system of government. At the same time that Madison believed that we needed a stronger national government, he never forgot the threat that governmental powers posed to rights. Hence his recommendation that we divide the national government's power among three departments that could check each other, and that we also divide the power of the most significant department, that is, the legislative branch. Additional evidence of his desire to check the government's power can be found in his call for a council of revision, something that we do not have, but that Madison thought was an important piece of the constitutional system that he wanted us to adopt. This council would have been made up of the president and members of the judicial branch, and it would have been armed with the power to examine and even negative acts of the legislative branch before they took effect. If Madison wanted a stronger central government than we had under the Articles, Brian, he also wanted responsible and non-tyrannical government.
Okay.
And he wanted especially to be able to check the legislative power.
It seems like he got about everything that he wanted, but we know, and your essay makes clear, there were challengers. There were those who offered a different plan for consideration. Yet, nevertheless, we end up with something close to the Virginia Plan. Can you give me an idea of what might have been the most important challenge offered to the Virginia Plan?
The most important challenge came from those people who believed that decent republics had to be small. And the Virginia Plan was proposing a large union with a strong national government. And so Madison had to overcome that challenge. And he did. There was an important debate that took place on June 6th between Madison and Roger Sherman, in which Madison demonstrated to the delegates that they would get more of what they wanted. And Madison said that he thought that what they wanted was protection for private rights, security for life, liberty, and property, that they would get more of that out of a national republic with a strong central government than out of something like the Articles of Confederation or a mere revision of a confederal system.
Okay, but coming out of the Constitutional Convention, Madison may have carried the day, but he and the others then had to sell it to the public through the ratification process, and they were putting forth a much stronger central government than was in existence before they met in Philadelphia. And Hamilton, for one, had to defend this, publicly defend the proposed Constitution by pointing to the limits it placed on government. He did this in the Federalist Papers, but explain it to us.
Yes, Hamilton, Madison, and Jay got together to write the Federalist Papers, a defense of the Constitution, urging delegates in New York, but in other states as well, to ratify the document that they had been sent by the Confederation Congress that had come out of the convention. Hamilton and Madison understood that the American people were worried about governmental tyranny after enduring the excesses of British rule. Knowing the state of mind of the American people, they took pains to emphasize the checks incorporated into the Constitution. Hamilton, for example, writes in Federalist Paper 9 that the framers drew on what he called improvements in the science of politics when drafting the Constitution. Examples he gave were the provisions for checks and balances and the creation of an independent national judiciary. Now, later in Federalist Paper 78, he will say that one of the major responsibilities of that independent judiciary would be to declare all legislative acts contrary to the Constitution to be null and void. In other words, to ensure the constitutional limits were observed by the legislative branch. As for Madison, he reminds his readers in Federalist 51 that the Constitution not only divided power among governments, that is, the states and the nation, but then within those governments, thus providing a double check against the threat of governmental tyranny. He clearly was confident that this institutional arrangement would increase the likelihood that the rights of the people would in fact be protected from abuse, and that the American people would understand this defense of the new constitutional system and be inclined, therefore, to embrace it and to support it.
Well, they bought his argument and they ratified the Constitution, but how has the idea fared over time in the United States? Has the implementation of limited federal government in the U.S. Constitution remained strong, or has it dissipated over the years?
Brian, I think the American people should feel very good about how things have worked out. We've not endured, as you know, any coup d'etats since 1789, when the new constitutional system went into effect. Washington voluntarily left office after two terms. We did not end up with an elective monarchy. Richard Nixon gave in to the court's demands in the Watergate tapes case. Presidents really don't like the War Powers Bill that confined their ability to deploy troops and keep them in hot spots, but they still abide by its terms. Members of Congress don't like it when the Supreme Court declares a law to be unconstitutional, but they go along. And the Bush administration has indicated that it is prepared to work with the courts in the Patriot Act cases. So all things considered, I think there's abundant evidence that the principle of limited government is alive and well in the United States.
Well, great. Well, that's where we'll have to leave it. We're out of time. But, David, thanks for joining us again.
Brian, it was a pleasure to be with you.
Great. I've been speaking with David Marion, Elliott Professor of Political Science at Hampton-Sydney College and Director of the Wilson Center for Leadership in the Public Interest. This is Talking History. Founders and the Constitution, in their own words, includes 24 units, each dedicated to a specific founder. Our guest this week, David Merriam, with whom we just spoke, prepared the following brief introduction to James Madison.
James Madison of Virginia did not look the part of a nation builder. He was short, only 5 feet 6 inches in height, thin, and apparently introverted. In poor health throughout his life, he often believed that death was near. His favorite attire was black clothing, a fitting sign of his usual somber mood. Madison's slight appearance and melancholy demeanor, however, gave little indication of the keen intellect and shrewd nature of the man. Perhaps no other person of the founding generation exercised as much influence as he did over the crafting, ratification, and subsequent interpretation of the Constitution and Bill of Rights. Due to his health problems, Madison did not fight in the Revolutionary War. Instead, he occupied himself with the political affairs of the Commonwealth of Virginia and the nation. As a member of the Continental Congress, he witnessed firsthand the inability of the government of the Articles of Confederation to address many of the problems of the states. He was pleased when the Confederation Congress invited the states to send delegates to a convention set for the summer of 1787 in Philadelphia. Madison spent part of the winter and spring preparing for the convention, so eager was he to get the reform process started that he arrived in Philadelphia 11 days early. Madison was no romantic, and his political theory was founded on the recognition that human beings are not angels, and that decency and competence are not easily preserved in political communities. He believed that people are inclined by nature to form factions or groups that promote their own interests at the expense of the common good. Factions pose a special problem for democratic societies, because a faction composed of the majority of the people can easily oppress the minority. To combat this, Madison favored a large republic with a multiplicity of interest groups and separation among legislative, executive, and judicial branches of the government. Additionally, he advocated adoption of a new style federal arrangement that divided power between the states and a national government. As he argued in Federalist No. 51, power must be set against power. Ambition must be made to counteract ambition. Many of Madison's ideas were reflected in the final version of the Constitution. An admirer of James Madison labeled him the father of the Constitution. Madison rejected the title, rightly claiming that the document was the work of many heads and many hands. He died at his home on June 28, 1836, at the age of 85, the last of the founders to pass away.
You've been listening to David Merriam, Elliott Professor of Political Science at Hampton-Sydney College and Director of the Wilson Center for Leadership in the Public Interest. This is Talking History. Finally, following up on David Merriam's remarks on James Madison, Fiona Beattie joins us to call your attention to a website where you can learn more about this particular founding father.
Nothing can be more absurd than the cavil that the Declaration contains known and not new truths. The object was to assert, not to discover truths, and to make them the basis of the Revolutionary Act. So wrote James Madison in a letter to Thomas Jefferson, September 6, 1823. This, along with letters, documents, teacher resources, and scholarly texts, are among some of the materials available online at the James Madison Center website. The center opened in 1999 on the campus of the James Madison University with the goal of collecting information on Madison's life and times. Online, the James Madison collection has images of pieces from the collection along with historical descriptions. The archival collection takes visitors from the genesis of American Revolution through the construction of the Constitution, including Madison's life and presidency. A separate section of related quotes includes John Quincy Adams's eulogy for Madison, published in the National Intelligencer on September 27, 1836. There are links to Montpelier, the home of James Madison, with photographs and images of the house and grounds. And if you're of musical inclination, there's Madison's March or the popular Mrs. Madison's Waltz. To find out more, go to www.jmu.edu, search word Madison Center.
And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. If you want to learn more about founders and the Constitution, in their own words, or if you're interested in seeing a valuable collection of related materials, visit the Bill of Rights Institute at www.billofrightsinstitute.org. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that our producer is Fiona Beattie, that our studio engineer is Alex Smith, and that the opinions offered by our guests on Talking History do not necessarily reflect those of the program staff or of the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. And finally, we invite you to send us your comments on this show by email, if you wish, to talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by regular mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.